So our first speaker up for the day is Musi Kuzwayo. He's a co-founder of South Africa's Promise, a non-profit organization whose mission is to help fulfill South Africa's constitutional promise of freeing the potential of each person. He has dedicated his life to understanding the people of South Africa. Musi was a newspaper columnist for over 20 years, writing for the Sunday Times, City Press, as well as the Star. He's also a co-founder of Ignitive, a marketing consultancy, whose mission it is to help ignite Africa to succeed. He's a former visiting professor at the University of Cape Town, Cape Town's Graduate School of Business, where he taught on marketing and doing it, approaching it through the paradigm of systems thinking. He's also written several books, and he has spoken to thousands of people in various forums throughout South Africa, and this makes him believe that South Africa is destined for greatness. He's also he previously was the CEO of TWA, a marketing company. He at some point owned a couple of pick and pay franchises, and he's also the director at the Spur Group. So obviously, well versed in the business environment, what South Africa is experiencing. And his talk today will be around South Africa, the promise creating the future we want for ourselves. Thanks, Musi. Welcome in.
Thanks, Sias. Thank you, bro. Sias, thank you for that wonderful introduction. And I hope that God gives us both very long and healthy lives. And please come read my obituary when I'm gone. Ladies and gentlemen, my grandmother grew up believing that German quality was the worst quality in the world. And being a researcher, being a student of marketing, even though I studied the sciences, I then decided to not dispute her and do my research and found that in her time it was true. She had been born in 1903. The British were aware of that, feeling, and how people thought that German quality was the worst quality in the world. So they passed the law of provenance that every product that goes into the colonies must have the country of origin, the provenance where it comes from. And people stopped buying German products. In fact, a lot of African people, when they talk of this shoes, it's Germany, because it was just mishmashed clothes. The Germans were aware of this thing, and they came up with the idea of the circle of excellence, which is why the old German logos are circular. BMW, Mercedes-Benz, Bayer, all of those companies. Audi. Porsche does not have one because they did not have one. It was a family crest that they put in much later when they were starting to export to the United States. And today we look and we think German quality is the best quality in the world. So I sought out to start a company called Ignitive years ago with my colleague Pumi Mashiko, who I'm going to ask to run the presentation for me, the pictures really, because the conversation more than the presentation. My hands are full and I need a third one for my water. So because we want to ignite Africa into success. And I'm really excited here because I've got people that I share kindred spirit, not in terms of brains, you guys being actuaries, but at least in terms of spirit. Next slide, please, Pumi. But guys, let's go big. South Africa, let's go big. You know, we don't know how, next slide, please. We don't know how the future looks like. We're traveling, we do a lot of work in the rural areas. And sometimes when you drive from Joburg, sometimes do 800 kilometers driving to the villages. This is one of the villages where we were driving to. I took a picture with a cell phone. The bridge is broken. You can't see further than that. But you know what? You can make the whole trip that way. We've driven 800 kilometers. 200-300 kilometers of that being in the dark. We don't know what the future looks like. We're all worried. But you know what? That's how you make the trip. Next slide, please. That's how we make the trip. Last year, after the violence and the looting in KZN, in Pietermaritzburg and Johannesburg and other parts of Natal, we took the first flight into Pietermaritzburg to try and help. And what we saw, I saw for the first time the AK-74, Now, AK-47s, we know them. We know how they sound. The AK-74 is a revamped. Now they've got a 74M that's coming out soon. And I saw it for free, but the Americans paid $5,000 for the first time it was released by the Russians. I saw companies hired mercenaries to come and protect their company, their businesses from being looted. And I once said to the one guy, Hindota, a traditional weapon in Janle. What kind of traditional weapon is this? He just laughed. They were all in their uniforms and some were in private clothes. But that's how things have degenerated. However, just like I shared with you in that picture, we don't have to see into the future, just where the headlights take us. And you know, when I was preparing for this meeting, there's somebody who really excited me. Nathaniel Bowditch, the first actuary in the United States. I'm sure you guys know about him, right? Didn't they teach you that at varsity? Go get the change. Go get the change. Nathaniel, he was a mathematician. He taught himself mathematics because at age 9, he had to leave school and work for his father's company. I think his father was in the shipping business. I think his dad must have gone into some financial problem because he became an indentured laborer. To say, okay, you can't pay my debt, your son's going to work for me. Well, he was lucky, didn't work on the fields. He became a bookkeeper. Hated it, but probably just had to do it. He had no choice. His dad wanted him working there. And he was interested in navigation, as you guys who are, the mathematicians. And then later on, he became the first actuary for a short-term insurance business in the United States. Navigation in Africa is a very important thing, but it doesn't happen all the time. These guys are in a ship. They're actually crossing in a ferry from one end of Mombasa to another. And sometimes if the weather's bad, people have sunk before in a lot of other African countries. And he helped with that and navigation. So, next slide, please. He had a really terrible life. Just like this little kid. A picture that we shot in KZN when we're driving back. He's supposed to be at school in many other parts of the world. Well, not many other parts of the world. In Johannesburg, on this just other side of the river. He has to go out in the mornings and take the cattle out, the head of cattle out. He has to come back in the afternoon while his counterparts, on the other hand, are busy on the internet finding a new world. But hey, guys, if Nathaniel Bowditch could make it as the first actuary, I am inviting you that let us give this kid a chance as well. Another slide, please, for me. And one of the things, so what we were finding out in KZN is this, people are still drinking water out of these kind of wells where cows drink as well. And one of the things that does happen, which is really sad, is kids do fall into this and drown. And guess who drowns in all the time there? The calves and the lambs, because they try to drink as well, but this is too deep for them. This might sound depressing, but there's Nathaniel Bowditch, guys. He made it. And all we're asking for you is for that. Let's give these other guys a chance. So we found a company, a South African family, up in Johannesburg, and said, you know what, could you please help us fund a well, a solar-powered well, using technology, latest technology, to give people water. And what we also did was we gave the local guys a job. We give them skills so they can start learning about water. And then after this, they'll be doing their computers. The really sad thing is that these guys, some of them are 28 years old, 30, have never had a job in their lives. I shook the guy's hands and I said, so what do you do? They said, well, couldn't you feel our hands, how soft they are? They've never touched anything. It does hurt. It's painful. But remember Nathaniel Bowditch. We're going to make this happen. Next slide, please, Bumi. When we got to Pietermaritzburg, as I said, we took a picture of these kids sitting in the rubble where the looting had happened. In fact, the family that helped here, one of their stores was burned down. In December, we had this thing happening where we gave what we decided to do when we got to Pietermaritzburg. The first thing you need to know, what is the problem? When we got there, we found that 65% don't have matric of the population there. Only 14% have a post-matric qualification. It's actually better than the national average. A lot of South Africans are not getting through matric, and education is a deep problem. So we decided, it's a big problem. So we decided we are going to shut down the devil's workshops. You know that old saying, an idle mind is a devil's workshop? Let's keep the kids busy. Worked with a lady in the States. She said, two things you need to do. She works with the African-American community. And she said, you know, we're in the United States of America, but there are people who have never seen an elevator in their lives here or an escalator. So don't worry. You're not alone. But there are two things you need to do. Keep them off the streets and keep them off from home. They should not be at home. Should get home only to go and sleep, because you want them studying, you want them working with computers. So we've kitted computers with homework centers with computers. Next slide, please. And why I believe we can do something about it is that I was born in Springs. I ended up being CEO of TBWA 100 Lascaris. Gave the guys the company when I joined. It was losing clients left, right, and center, and they offered me the job as MD. I said, I don't want to be MD. I'm just busy. I enjoy writing books. Eventually, I said, no, I'll take the job, but on one condition, that Hunt Lascaris becomes number one in the world. Now, with the advertising industry, it's easy because you've got the Gun Report. You can evaluate that. And I took the job. I left it in 2008. This was 2007 when I gave the guys the role that we're going to, the task that we're going to be number one in the world. Because what I had learned while teaching business and things is that if you have a challenge, don't worry about the problems at your feet. Look at the door. Let's go bigger and further. Don't worry. The problems at your feet are just going to sink you. That's all they're going to do. And I was born, and what I want to do, and what we're trying to do with South Africa's Promise, is give guys the same opportunity that I had, that kid who was herding the cattle. I'm inviting you guys to, let's give those a chance in the same way that I got these chances. So I was born, my mom and dad were never married. And my grandmother raised me with grant money, which she used to get once in 3 months. I had relatives who loved me and a lot of strangers along the way who opened doors they did not have to open. Now, we are those strangers. Let's open doors that we don't have to open because we're busy with a lot of other things. And this is where I was born, in Painville. Now, Painville is a pre-apartheid society. Pre-apartheid. 1928 it was built. Apartheid only came in 48, but was so focused with what happened between 1948 and 1994. So in my family, we call it United Nations. And it's always good going to Springs. There was a funeral. It's not good to go to funerals, but you get to see everybody. And we speak all the languages, Afrikaans, everything. And unfortunately, I was telling Pumi, the dialect of Afrikaans that I grew up with is dead. Because we didn't say, for instance, I remember when I first got into class and we taught Afrikaans. And you go like, but I think the teacher is making a mistake. Because we did not say, it had a more Dutch than what Afrikaans has today. You didn't say Gand, you say Gat. There's a lot of it still in the Cape, and if you look at the statues in Cape Town, it's written like that to a large extent, some of the old ones. So, and we didn't say ge, we say ga. Die man het gegaan. That's how we spoke. So I get into class, die man het gegaan. Oh no, this is, and my love for Afrikaans died. So, because I was told that what we were speaking at home, what everybody else was speaking, was wrong. And my sister spoke Afrikaans before she spoke English. My sister's cleverer than me, but she told me that no, not really that. It's because she used to take the question paper and turn it around and read the Afrikaans, which is a lot easier, and then get better marks. But because then we decided that we wanted to separate people, she spoke Afrikaans before she spoke Zulu, by the way. And then they decided, that's it. So I've got family. I've got colored family. I've got Indian family. We always laugh. We've got Zulu, Sotho, everybody. Many other people have got the same thing who were born in Painville and Sophiatown and all of those pre-apartheid townships. So they decided they were going to separate blacks and whites. They're just too close. They felt it was too close, so they moved us to Guatemala. I did not see my sister for a good 10 years because she was classified as colored. And then the houses were demolished and just left like that. So I went back to take pictures of the houses. Later on, much later, it was only around year 2000, or even later actually, when they rebuilt the township again. Look, it was a tough time, but it was also a good time. This is where PATCO came into the township. Every town hall, every town council had its own buses. And then they did a deal with some family, and the National Party government decided this is it. They were going to have PATCO coming in. And we had a whole boycott of Azikwelo. We're not getting into PATCO buses. People bought bicycles and started riding to work. It was a wonderful thing. So in the mornings, you just see like a traffic of bicycles going up. And the police did not like that. So they came up with a story that there was a woman who'd been kidnapped and taken underground. It was a mining town and was taken underground, and everybody stopped riding their bicycles. Although there was all of those stories, we also had some good times there. So this little road is where, this is a bus stop where we used to get off when I was going to school. And then this little road there has got very fond memories for me. We used to buy our chips, a quarter, what people call quarter now, quarter loaf of bread, open it, put Erica butter, and then put in your hot chips there, then it starts to melt, or it just starts to melt, the butter. And then you roll it nicely, you want to make it a nice flat sandwich. You put it on the road for the bus to drive on it. It just goes whap, and it's nice and flat after that. But the problem with that is that the bus has got the two wheels at the back, right? The pair of wheels. So sometimes it goes in there like a brick, and then your sandwich is gone. So what do? The alternative is to sit on it. You just sit on it a few times. Which was also good because we have a saying in African languages called mping ping wala pisa. Gimme, gimme leads to poverty. So we're told never give kids money on the streets, because then they don't go to school. It's as simple as that. But the good thing is when you're sitting on your bread, is that when somebody comes and asks for a piece of bread and you don't want to give them, ping ping wala pisa, what do? You fart on your bread. Boop. They're not going to ask you for that. Hey, but it's yours. It doesn't matter, isn't it? I think they call it recycling these days. Another one, please, mommy. So the houses didn't come with toilets. Forget the bathroom. Didn't come with toilets. Every two streets shared toilets. And we were on 4th Street, which people called Kakstraat, because that's where you used to come and do your business. And every morning, so, I mean, we needed a bucket. There was a big chamber pot business, small ones for kids, potties, and then the big ones for adults. And you best clean your chamber pot early in the morning, because think about it. Very quickly, there are a lot of you. You're probably 12 or something like that in the house. I remember with holidays at our house, there'd be 25 of us. We were counting the one time. So what you want to do is you want to get out as quickly as possible, do your chores, and go clean your, and go play. And you need to go and clean your chamber pot. Now, remember we were in Kakstraat, and my brother was terrible, Freddy, really terrible. He used to sit outside here and look at people who are going to the toilet and just enjoyed it. So one of the people he enjoyed looking at was the school principal, you know, and I mean, and he used to say it all the time. And the school principal, you know, it was little things that we were trying to distinguish ourselves. So toilet papers were very scarce. Only rich people could afford toilet papers. We used newspapers. And if you had the Joburg Yellow Pages book, you had the jackpot, because it's quite thick. You know, it's got both telephone and everything. But he used to go, as a relative of ours, he used to walk with his toilet paper so everybody could see him that he was using a toilet paper going down Kakstraat. And my brother would sit there on the stoop outside and go, "Hello, Tishar. Gujan, how are you? We are happy. Where are you going? Uyokaka, are you going to give a dump?" And my mother would say, "Stop it, stop it." And the same thing would happen with people who are going to clean the chamber pots. But what those things did to people is they killed people's dignity. The washing had to be done here as well. This is the washing stands. They were communal washing stands, whatever. In fact, I got a scar here. I was with my mom and she was doing washing and the horse came by. So in rebuilding our country as South Africans, we have to rebuild people's dignity. The dignity, well, the principle has since passed on. But the indignity, for instance, that Freddie meted out on the adults and many other kids did, that is what we need to rebuild. My grandmother used to say, the worst crime of apartheid was to make parents and their children to sleep in the same room. We used to make jokes about it. We used to go, you know, the old beds had chains. They did not have springs. So they were quite noisy. Each time you moved, it was ticky, ticky. And so when the parents start doing their business at night, bringing new people in the house without asking the stakeholders who are lying in the, who are sleeping on the floor, they start doing their business, would go like, oh, okay. Then you hear the bed goes ticky, 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 ticky. And family planning wasn't a great thing. So what did you do? Coitus interruptus. There's a Latin name for it. Jump out. Yeah. So the parent would go ticky, ticky, ticky. And then would just jump over. He didn't care, Dad, because the kids are sleeping on the floor. So he could just land on the kids. Okay, sorry. And then they just continue. And then the goy goy and them said, you must have a plan. When you hear the bed, it starts to go ticky, 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 ticky. You just go under the bed. And when he jumps, he's going to go plonk on the floor. And we'd talk about it. And we'd laugh about that. And then the other kid, our priest told us that they were talking about kids. And the kid said, Minu baba mudla makandle. My dad eats candles. It's kind of thing that's difficult to translate into English. But utuk mamam, those who speak, will you just blow the candle? They're laughing. Will you just blow the candle and give me a piece? So it's you know, go easy, girls. But that's the indignity that South Africa has done to its people. So guys, we can't do anything without rebuilding the dignity of ourselves, making us believe in ourselves again. This is a picture on the right-hand side of kids in Germany after the war, learning out in the open. And this is the picture that we're familiar with of kids learning out in the cold and in the sun. They're wearing beanies and blankets. Ours are under the tree because it's hotter. But in no time, they have built a great and amazing, they've built from the ruins and look at where Europe is. So we don't have a monopoly, guys, on suffering. We don't have a monopoly on suffering. Next one, please, for me. But what must we do? Because we can do this. The first thing I'm going to ask you guys is actually, next one, please, for me, is we need to stop the brain flight. A country that's losing its brain power will never be able to power ahead. I don't know about actuaries, but we know about the stats about black chartered accountants in London, that there are 120 black chartered, South African black chartered accountants who've left the country because the country is giving them no opportunity. We know the statistics in terms of unemployment and all of those things, but we have to revise, we have to relook all the policies that we have so that you guys don't leave the country. Because if the brains have left, there is nothing left. It's just the body walking and the heart beating. You know, it's a ghost. We are in ghost town. We're working in KZN, as I mentioned to you, and we speak to the chief. The chief had tears in his eyes. He says, you know, nothing is worse than being a chief to people who are hungry. People who have got no jobs. Look at the kids. They're sitting, they're doing nothing. He says, I love what you guys are saying and what you guys are doing, but here's the problem. Is that from here, we must go to the municipal manager. He's going to get it. He's an educated guy. He's going to get it. The councillor and the mayor are going to ask me, what's in it for me? So guys, here is an opportunity. Last slide. Here's an opportunity. Let's make South Africa go big. In conclusion, I love photography. I took almost all of those pictures except for Nathaniel Bowditch, of course, because it was before my time. So one day I had a rustling. This is at my mom's house. I was sleeping, and I hear rustling in the middle of the night. I turn on the light. These are the curtains. I see a little mouse over there. So instead of killing the mouse, I go, let me get my camera. I get my camera and start taking the pictures of the mouse. I took it off with film, so it's degraded over time. And the reason why I've got this up, it reminded me of Aesop's fable, of the mice complaining about a cat. To say, here's this cat, it's harassing us. What can we do? And then they came together and said, you know what we must do? We don't want to kill the cat, just like I did not want to kill the mouse. I took a picture of the mouse. And he said, let's wait for the cat to go to sleep. And when the cat is asleep, we're going to put a bell around the cat. So that when the cat moves around, we can hear the bell ringing. So he said, okay, let's put the bell around the cat. So that when the cat moves around, we can hear the sound of the bell going. They all agreed. That's what they were going to do. And then somebody said, okay, guys, we've got the deal. But who is going to bell the cat? Now, I'm asking you, ladies and gentlemen, please, let's bell the cat. We know what needs to be done. Bell the cat, bring your brain. We've got the best brains in the country. I hope you don't mind. If I can put our website up there. Next one, please. We're on southafricaspromise.org.za. We need brains. Because if we've got brains, we're going to turn the country around. I had a guy tell me that if a country loses 10% of its matriculants from the best high schools, 10% of the best high schools, not all of the high schools, that country gets into trouble because the best brains leave. And so you won't do research. Now you won't be able to do, the universities won't have the best students. Companies won't have the best students. So, but I'm not so disappointed because I've met you guys and I know you guys are going to stay in the country and I know you guys are going to make South Africa. When people talk about South Africa many years from now, they'll tell the same story that I told about Germany. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Anybody that wants to ask Musi a question about what they're doing or what we could be doing or to inspire us? Nobody. Musi, can I maybe ask?
There's a question. What does South Africa's Promise do? You know, we're trying to do what the Constitution says of giving everybody an opportunity to explore their full potential. That's what it says. It sounds vague, but that's what we're doing. That's why we're going to places, we speak to people, find out what the problem is, try to make a difference. So if we can galvanize, in the same way that in advertising, we're able to galvanize hearts and minds, if we can galvanize everybody's heart and mind like this, to want to do something, we believe we'll be able to go elsewhere. And then here's another thing, which a lot of people find actually confusing. My belief, which is something I learned in management, don't hire people to tell them what to do. There's no point, because then they're just executing what you're trying to say. Hire the best people and then give them the problem. They will sort it out themselves. Never ever tell a bright person what to do. You're wasting that resource. Give them the problem. They will find a solution. So that's the problem that I've put through to you guys. But I will not suggest a solution to you. Because then I'm assuming that I've got better brains than you guys. And we know it's not true. I couldn't do mathematics. You know, I just did biochemistry and microbiology. We know it's not true. But I can say, oh, you must do this 1, 2, 3, and 4. That's for my ego. If I've got brains, make the brains work. I hope that answers you. It's an unusual answer. Some of my staff used to get incredibly frustrated when I said, no, we've got the best solutions. And by the way, TBWA did become number one in the world in 2010. They phoned me in 2009 to say, you gave us this task to be number one in 2010. It was in 2009 when Carol Soames called me, and I was out in Nimtad in Step Strait. And she said, we're not number one, but we are fighting number two. In 2010, Pumi organized all the people whom she hired. They became number one. And it was new people who had never solved communications problems before. And I even became a greater believer in the fact that get bright people and give them the problem and let them find the solution.
I see. If you're brave enough to ask a question, you're going to get one of Musi's books.
So oh, is that why he's got the books? Yeah. Well, somebody got up and said the other day, said, I don't have a question, but I do want the book.
Musi, maybe in 5 minutes, if you can tell us about South Africa's Promise, the book.
Thank you. So, the book, I was a lousy student. Difficult concepts. I couldn't deal with them well, but my dad used to believe that it's because difficult concepts are taught in a very difficult manner. So my dad was like you guys, he was a maths guy. Well, you guys are actuaries. He was a maths guy, so in maths and chemistry, and they were not allowed at Rhodes University. He studied at Rhodes with Chris Arney, but they were not allowed on the campus, so they were only allowed to sit across the lecturer and do maths. And then he became very interested in teaching maths. So the first thing he said is to teach maths in the mother tongue. It's a lot easier. Isaac Newton couldn't believe or did not believe that maths and physics could be taught in English. In fact, Nathaniel Bowditch had to study Latin so he could read Principia. But today, you guys studied maths either in Afrikaans or English, right? Newton thought it's impossible. And my dad felt that you could teach maths in isiZulu. Or Sesotho or something. And he used to make a very simple example that if you send a child to go buy candles, because load shedding was something we knew all the time. In winter, the suburbs, the light stays on at Ride Park, but in spring, in Guatemala, we don't have lights. That doesn't justify load shedding by no means. But so you're going to buy, there are two things we were always sent in winter, candles and matches. So it says if a child goes to buy a candle, to buy matches, he comes back with change, he's solved an X. He buys candles and matches, he solved a simultaneous equation. So teach the mathematics that way. Now, in this book, so that's become something that I learned from him. Of teach people in things that they can relate to. So this book is about building a country, essentially. I've made it very short. It's about 100 and something pages, 109 pages. And the reason why it's short, it's because people are busy, but also people want to feel like they finished the book. My previous books, people used to read on the way to Cape Town on the plane and finish it on the way back. So I decided I was going to keep it nice and short so that they can read it on the way down. But trust me, easy reading is very hard writing. So you need to take out the words that you don't need. Don't clear your throat in a book. So in this case, what I did is I created a fictitious person called Hakuna and a sage. And they're set in the cradle of mankind, or cradle of humankind, I beg your pardon. And they talk about what can be done to make South Africa better. Hakuna comes from the name Hakuna Matata. And the reason why I've set it at the cradle of mankind is because as South Africans, we are so concerned with colonialism and apartheid and forget that we are the custodians of humanity. Don't look at the 400 years when you've got more than 5,000 years or even longer. So I'm trying to expand that vision because one of the things I've always liked to do and say to managers, think about your company, especially entrepreneurs who are starting a company. Think about your company, how your company is going to look like 200 years from now. So in this journey, they're talking about citizen service, for instance. So what you want to do is every child who finishes school needs to learn responsibility. We had a workshop in Orange Grove. We had it not in Orange Grove, in Orange Farm. And I said, girls, you're going to keep quiet. I'm going to ask only the boys. Boys, where do you get a teaspoon from? They think, oh, the one boy got up and said, just from a drawer. They think drawers come with teaspoons. They've never learned to be responsible adults. So you need your 2 years to train them to become responsible, to train them to learn to give before they get anything. We talk about safety, how to build safety in our society. I was shocked when I discovered that there are people in South Africa who can't walk with their IDs when they go home because they're scared that, or they kind of expect to be mugged when they go to a taxi or to a bus. Now, I'm a big guy. It's never happened to me. The only time I was ever mugged, I think I was 10 years old by a neighbor. and that's it. You know, it's never happened. And there's one time only a person. So it talks about safety. It talks about those kinds of things. We talk about health as well. Health is a very, very important thing. So there's things and education. You know, when you, your country, 65% of people don't have matric. A lot of them think education does not matter. And also what has happened in our vocabulary, in our country, is somebody's come up with a term, a very vicious term of clever blacks, as if it's uncool to be educated. So this book is trying to change that. It's trying to change that narrative, to say, guys, we can create a country that we want, a country that is awesome. I worked in the United States when I was younger, and New York was a bad place. The crime statistics had just turned. Business people were getting shot in the streets. It turned out some of them were mafia. But that's what was happening. And you look at what it is today, it's a very different country. And you black guys, I tell you, please don't go to the States. They're going to shoot you. The police shoot black people there. So you're stuck.
Musi, one question from the online attendees. Do you have any guidance for us to remain informed and avoid fake news?
Fake news is a big problem internationally. I studied artificial intelligence with MIT, and it's one of the things that we discussed a lot. I think the solution that is being suggested is get as many alternative sources as possible. And then you'll be able to decipher, or at least come to a conclusion, which one is wrong or right. But at the moment, there is no worldwide solution, and machines are spitting it out. They find your profile. The algorithms kind of know what it is that you're likely to believe in. And that's how radicalization is happening. There's radicalization on all sides and on all fronts. And it's very hard to deal with it. But the only thing that you can do yourself is read as many sources as possible. There's an app, I forget its name, I must actually check it, on my phone. It asks you, actually, if you want to read left-wing news or left. It's called Improve the News. That's what it is. Improve the News. And it asks you on the app, are you interested in the left or on the right or more center? But that's how it is. And with algorithms, with artificial intelligence and algorithms, that's been heightened like crazy now.
Thanks. One more question. Gail, can you please do the mic? Thanks.
Thanks, Muzi. I really enjoyed your talk.
Thank you.
I often daydream about what I personally would do in South Africa, if I had the ability to redirect all resources, all spend, you know, what problems and would I tackle and in what order? And I often think that I would redirect everything at education from like the youngest age possible all the way up to sort of tertiary education. What would you do if you had that ability to redirect all our resources and spend and focus and energy? What would, you know, what would you prioritize?
How controversial can I get? I'm serious.
I think you've crossed that bridge already.
So, you know, it is controversial, I think. Or maybe it's unusual. So I read a book called End of an Empire, How Empires End. I'll just take a little more 1 minute because I think it's very important. This is very important, but I need to give you the rationale for it. End of an Empire. So Russia used to be a big empire, and it fell apart when they started excluding Jewish people. Lithuania, and they expelled them. And this is in the late 1800s. And so South Africa benefited from that unfortunate event of pogroms. A lot of Jewish people came to South Africa, and others went to Chicago. This was before Hitler even. And the whole thesis of the book is that once you start to exclude a certain group of people, you're going to lose a lot more people. And it's about Russia and Spain and all of those empires. And Portugal. Can you believe Portugal used to be an empire? You know, guys, you know what I do? And it's... and I'm a beneficiary of it. I'm a beneficiary of it. I'd stop Black economic empowerment. I'd stop it because I benefited from it, and I'm truly grateful. Affirmative action, for that, I'm truly grateful. But what it does to your people, it says to the kid who's 18, the white kid, who's bright, who got straight A's, the queue is long, and I only have 1% chance of making it. And then he leaves or she leaves the country to start a company elsewhere. Because they're bright. They're the ones who are going to make the money. That's how it goes. And your black kids as well, see your white kids, the equally black kids, equally bright black kids, see the white kids going that side, and they follow them. So, and then the other side, they go, oh, wow, South Africa's got some really bright kids. And they come and they headhunt your entrepreneurs, which has happened, you know that. It's happened, they've taken black and white, they're up everywhere. Oh, the person, Matlaid Indlov, the person who organized, who helped Belgium with COVID response is Matlaid Indlov from the Free State. You know how we battled here. They took off their masks long before. Because that's what happens. So what you want to do is you want to retain them as much as possible and then throw your money into education. So am I sounding like the guy who gets up the stairs and then take them off and put them here? Maybe. But that is the truth. I've worked with talent all my life. I know it's very hard to keep talent. My job is to find youngsters when they come in. There's a lady, Shirley, I said to her, listen, when you hit the big fire, when you hit the big one, please don't forget me. This was in her first 2 months. I got a call from London about 6 months ago saying there's a lady, we want to have an interview with you, because a lady called Shirley Smaller says you're a mentor, you wrote a book called Marketing Through Mud and Dust, and she used to work for you. And she heads up Droga 5, the number one agency in the world now. So I know you to keep talent, you fight for keeping talent. I learned that while I was having a soccer team. But we need brains and we need ways to make people realize that.
Thanks, Mr. One more question from our online attendees. What influenced your life the biggest? And how did it impact you?
What influenced my life the biggest? You know, I think it's actually jazz music. Because these are guys who had no opportunity, who had to play music and entertain people and make the world a better place. There were a lot of other people also who were not jazz musicians, of course. I can think of Father Dominic, I can think of my parents, my mother, my father, my grandmother mostly, that being the person, because I guess. But I think I like the way jazz was. When I learned, having been a visiting professor at UCT, I read a lot of business books. I read a lot of business cases from Harvard and everything. But I think the jazz musicians, having asked me that question, the one who comes to mind is Miles Davis, who had had a problem and with drugs and jazz changing. And a youngster called Marcus Miller came up to him and said, listen, I want to write a song for you. And they wrote the song Tutu. And they were young, they were not famous at all. They used to do advertising jingles, if anything. And Miles Davis looked at the song, liked the song, and as he says, he said, you know, the only thing I wanted to do was just, instead of the lead singer or the big jazz musician playing in front of them, he wanted to play behind them. And that they just changed the industry. And I think if we can get younger people, so what I learned from that was that give younger people a chance, let them make mistakes, they're going to make them, very embarrassing mistakes. Like with me in case of Mandla at TBWA, who were bidding for the World Cup 2010, once in a lifetime kind of thing. And he was 10 minutes late. I didn't fire him. He was young. He was probably playing along the way. But we kept him. And that year, Mandla brought us more than 400 million rands worth of business. So I give young people a chance. Let them sort out the problems themselves. Because if I tell them what to do, I'm telling them of the world that I know, that I'm most comfortable in, with, and they are living in a different world that needs different solutions. So that's how that Miles Davis album, please do check it out, called Tutu, and the live shows that came out of that, for me was probably the most, the single most influence in how I view life.
Thanks. Let's just thank Musi for his speak. I can just say his book is also available on Kindle, and I think us as South African citizens, we've got a responsibility to debate solutions and contribute, and there's a lot of good ideas in that book, so I would recommend it's a quick read. Go and pick it up on Kindle.